You start with an idea in your head, and you take a step, then a second. Soon you realize you're up to your neck in something intense, but it doesn't matter. You keep at it for the sheer pleasure of it, for the pure satisfaction it might bring you.
Previews of coming attractions.
It's very common in Hollywood to dump horror movies in January. It's typically a quiet period for the North American box office. They don't promote them, they just quietly release these movies, and if they happen to make a few bucks on one of them, great. My wife and I initially bonded over going to see Underworld 3, the remake of My Bloody Valentine, and The Unborn in the first few weeks of 2009. Anyway, I watched the trailer for Insidious, The Last Key, and I know it's part of a series of supernatural horror films, but I'm pretty sure I haven't watched any of them yet. And I had no idea that part of the deal with them is that there's some kind of demon with old-timey keys for fingers. Apart from that, it seemed to have a lot of the tropes that American haunted house movies have taken from Asian horror films over the last 20 years. It stars veteran character actor Lin Shaye, as well as the late Bruce Davison, and it was directed by actor-director Adam Robitel, who also wrote the screenplay for one of the Paranormal Activity films, which I'm afraid I also haven't seen. It was produced by James Wan, who's done everything from writing Saw to directing Furious 7. He is currently producing a new Mortal Kombat movie and is one of the writers on the Aquaman movie. As for Insidious, what can I say? When it comes to horror these days, I'm feeling less of these haunted house jump scare franchises, and I'm more into the more socially relevant, smart films like Get Out or It Follows, or just innovative, low-budget stuff like Ty West's films, or even just stuff that's technically interesting like VHS. So I don't think I'll be catching Insidious The Last Key on the big screen, if ever. Adam Robitel is shooting another picture right now called The Maze, starring Deborah Ann Woll from Daredevil and True Blood, and Logan Miller, and Canadian treasure Tyler Labine, so that sounds a lot more promising.
Previously on Sunday Night in Cinema 3.
Hollywood frequently complains about how box office revenue is down, and moviegoers complain about how Hollywood lacks imagination, going back to franchises and remakes of older successful films because they think that audiences will automatically prefer a familiar name to something they've never heard of. If nothing else, it saves them some marketing time and expense. One Missed Call was an American remake of a foreign film, and that can be lucrative. It was also coming in at the tail end of a trend that really took off with the remake of The Ring, starring Naomi Watts. The original version of One Missed Call was called Chakushin Ari, and please, pardon me if I butcher the pronunciation of a foreign film title. And it was directed by the great Takashi Miike. Again, sorry about the pronunciation, I'm probably very wrong. Like many Japanese horror films of the time, it involves a supernatural force that leverages technology, in this case, voicemail, to terrify its victims before they die. I think that One Missed Call might have been the end of that first wave of Asian horror remakes by Hollywood. There have, of course, been plenty of great Asian horror films produced since. In any case, the first thing you'll notice about One Missed Call is that no one has any smartphones, which in 2008, fair enough, I guess. There aren't even any Nokia phones or Sidekicks, just little palm-sized flip phones. The haunting in this form is a weird kind of self-own, where you hallucinate aspects of the restless spirit's death, then it kills you, and then your phone is butt-dialed by a ghost to the next person, who hears a recording of their own impending final moments. So in a weird way, it's like Final Destination with an angry child ghost, of course, and flip phones. The first on-screen victim is played by Megan Good from the Minority Report TV series. She and her cat get dragged into a backyard pond, which I guess is supposed to indicate that the ghost means business. She's just the latest in a long string of victims that included Ed Burns' sister. Fortunately, Burns is a cop who's seen it all, so he doesn't think it's weird that all these people are dying with nothing apparent in common, except for a creepy red spherical candy that they have in their mouths after they die. He meets up with Shannon Sossaman, who also knows a couple of the victims, and together they track down the ghost's remains, of course, while pretty much everyone they know is cut down around them. The supporting cast is surprisingly strong considering the material, including Ray Wise as a charlatan paranormal investigator, and Margaret Cho as Ed Burns' boss. Incidentally, if anyone out there has the power to make it happen, I would watch a series called Margaret Cho, Skeptical Cop. There are a few interesting moments in the film, and they get points for trying to make it look interesting, but let's not kid ourselves. This is a very predictable exercise in jump scares and bad CG that has not aged well. The cast is still working for the most part. Shannon Sossaman was on Wayward Pines and Mistresses. Ed Burns has been in a bunch of stuff in the last 10 years, and Ariel Winter, who played the creepy ghost girl, has been a very busy young actor, currently working on Modern Family. The director, Eric Vallette, has done some good television series, including the French series Braquo, and the international series Crossing Lines, which I do recommend and is available on Netflix. He also has a new film called Le Serpent aux Mille Coupures, or The Snake with a Thousand Cuts, I guess, more or less, which sounds good.
Please, record your conclusions.
Okay, well, let's see what we have here for the quality control questions. Did I enjoy this film more 10 years later? No, not really. Has the film been remade, or have there been sequels? No, not that I'm aware of. And finally, would I recommend people watch the film now? No, I would not.
Thank you for your input.
You're welcome.
Intermission.
Well, it's a new year, and while that may be a dumping ground for Hollywood, it is a time of hope and optimism for many others. So what are your movie-related resolutions for 2018? Are you finally going to watch Krzysztof Kieślowski's Trois Couleurs trilogy? Will you finally go to that film festival you've been wanting to do? Are there certain types of films that you want to see a lot more of this year? Let me know by sending an email to sundaynightincinema3@gmail.com, tweet at the Sunday Night in Cinema 3 account on Twitter, or message the Sunday Night in Cinema 3 Instagram or Facebook page. You can find links to all that stuff at sundaynightincinema3.com. Since it's not just a new year, but also the first episode of the podcast, this seems like a good moment to give you some idea of what you're dealing with when you listen to me talk about movies. Every year for the last 20 years, maybe more, I've been making up top 10 lists of the movies that I see, with a few rules. They have to be released that year, or at least released in North America that year. Originally, I only listed movies that I saw on the big screen, which at one time averaged about one a week. But thanks to streaming and a quicker turnaround for DVDs, that has dropped off a bit. For various reasons, I didn't see as many films on the big screen in 2017 as I usually do. I won't go into the details of that here, but you can read more in the first blog post of 2018 on the Sunday Night in Cinema 3 website. So, first, here are the films that I liked well enough to keep out of the bottom 10, but not enough to put into the top 10, in no particular order. The Lego Batman Movie, Logan, The Void, Spider-Man Homecoming, John Wick 2, The Girl with All the Gifts, Kong Skull Island, Personal Shopper, The Belko Experiment, Life, Colossal, The Fate of the Furious, Alien Covenant, Baywatch, Transformers The Last Knight, The Beguiled, The Little Hours, Atomic Blonde, Kingsman The Golden Circle, and Take Every Wave, The Life of Laird Hamilton. So next up are my least favorite films of 2017, again in no particular order. Ordinarily this would be a bottom 10 list, but I actually didn't see enough bad films to make a bottom 10. It's something like 7 or 8, so that's a good year, or a sign I was being a little more selective, or just good luck maybe. In any case, the worst films, as far as I'm concerned, in 2017 are Underworld Blood Wars, XXX The Return of Xander Cage, The Great Wall, Chips, The Ghost in the Shell, the remake, of course, the live-action remake with Scarlett Johansson, it's terrible, Valerian, Geostorm, and Darren Aronofsky's Mother. Probably no real huge surprises there. The Aronofsky film is more of an honorable mention because, you know, there's no doubt in my mind that the production and performances of the film are very good, but the end product is just an incredibly unpleasant experience, and it would be silly to pretend otherwise. So there were a lot of films that I missed last year that I would have liked to have seen, and some others that are being celebrated, which I had no interest whatsoever in seeing, most notably the biographical film about the late Maude Lewis, a painter from my hometown here in Nova Scotia. I have many opinions about Maude Lewis and her art, and if anyone really cares to hear them, I'll consider watching the film and posting a review, but for now, no thanks. Of the films that I did see, here are the ones that I enjoyed the most in 2017. At number 10, Free Fire. It was a smart, profane, and darkly funny period crime picture from British director Ben Wheatley, who also made the even more outrageous adaptation of High Rise. You could be forgiven for comparing this film to Reservoir Dogs. At number 9, Lady Bird. It's a smart and funny coming-of-age film set in the recent past, written and directed by the celebrated indie film actor Greta Gerwig. She's excellent, and Laurie Metcalf also steals every scene she is in as the main character's mother, and it would be surprising if she does not take home some awards for it. At number 8, Star Wars The Last Jedi. Rian Johnson injects a welcome dose of darkness into the, quote, final trilogy of the franchise, while exposing and dismissing a number of tired Joseph Campbell hero's journey conventions. I didn't enjoy every moment of it. It feels overstuffed and also weirdly slow at times, but I respect how Johnson and his cast and crew managed to unify and execute so many disparate demands. As a Buddhist, I also enjoyed how the film takes the mythology and ideas that George Lucas and company have borrowed over the years and reframes them in a less orientalist and more practical fashion. At number 7 is Guardians of the Galaxy 2. Lots of films dive into daddy issues, but none are quite as amusing and subversive as this. If I had a cosmic cube, I would replace every DVD of There Will Be Blood with a copy of Guardians of the Galaxy 2. At number 6, Wonder Woman. It drags in places and suffers from the Zack Snyder school of third acts, but the sheer joy of Gal Gadot's performance and her supporting cast carries us through the awkward bits to create an excellent template for a DC superhero film. It remains to be seen, of course, whether Warner Brothers will take that hint. At number 5, The Big Sick. Another smart dramedy, this one based on the true story of star Kumail Nanjiani and his wife, Emily Gordon, directed superbly by Michael Showalter. As with Lady Bird, an excellent supporting work by comedy veterans playing their parents. At number 4, Get Out. There weren't many horror films this year that I found interesting or exciting, and on paper, Get Out sounds like something that could have been a sketch on writer-director Jordan Peele's former comedy series. But he and his cast do an excellent job of walking a very difficult line, embracing and subverting the conventions of horror films, where innocent white kids find themselves fighting for survival in a strange and hostile environment. It's a perfect film for Trump's America. At number 3, Blade Runner 2049. Denis Villeneuve brings his considerable skill to a film that, like its predecessor, was as much about atmosphere and ambiguity as it was about solving a mystery. In the ever-growing ranks of films based on or inspired by Philip K. Dick, it easily drops into the top 5. At number 2, Baby Driver. Like Quentin Tarantino, Edgar Wright has made a career out of finding fresh and funny ways to tell stories that we've seen before. It's not a perfect film, but it is a lot of fun, with some great action set pieces and a smart script. There's a lot to love about Baby Driver. And at number 1, Thor Ragnarok. You probably don't need me to sell you on this one, so I'll just reiterate what others have pointed out. This film is a glorious, freewheeling ride into the minds of Jack Kirby and others who created and developed the Marvel characters, and it's one which brilliantly employs the theme of Ragnarok, the death of the old gods and their replacement by the young, to set the stage for a new phase of the Marvel films that have dominated Hollywood for the last decade. People complain about the Marvel Cinematic Universe, sometimes for good reason. Thor Ragnarok addresses those complaints and brings a much-needed evolution to its title character and the Marvel Cinematic Universe. And it was simply the most fun I had at the movies in 2017, so it deserves the top spot.
And now, our feature presentation.
This week's pick from my DVD collection is the original version of The Vanishing, written and directed by George Sluzer. Maybe that's Slitzer, sorry. Released in 1988. It was a Dutch-French co-production based on a short novel called The Golden Egg. It's safe to say that the film was the height of Schlitzer's career, maybe, as a director, though he is also known for directing River Phoenix's last film, Dark Blood, in 1993. It remained unfinished for 19 years and was finally recut by the director and released in 2012 before his own death in 2014. The Vanishing introduces us to a young Dutch couple called Rex and Saskia. They're on vacation, traveling into the mountains for a cycling holiday, listening to the Tour de France on the radio as they drive. Saskia tells Rex about a dream she had, a new variation about a recurring dream, where she is floating through space inside of a golden egg. They argue about being low on gas and then run out of gas in a long tunnel. Exasperated, Rex gets out of the car and walks back the way they came, while Saskia begs him not to leave her alone in the dark. But he's angry and sees no alternative if they want to continue. When he returns to the car, she's gone. He drains his jerry can, starts the car, and drives on through the tunnel looking for her. As he approaches the end of the tunnel, he sees her in a golden circle of light waiting for him. She gets back in the car, and they put the incident behind them. Rex pulls into a rest stop so they can top up their fuel and get some food. Saskia goes back inside to buy them some drinks. Rex busies himself at the car, taking a few Polaroid pictures and writing descriptions on them. It soon dawns on him that Saskia has been gone for a while. He goes into the station, checks around the parking lot, but doesn't see her. He appeals to the rest stop manager and employees and eventually to the police, but to no avail. Saskia has disappeared. As Rex's panic builds, the spare soundtrack of the film surges, adding another layer to The Vanishing's already strong resemblance to an Alfred Hitchcock film. Watching The Vanishing now, it still holds up excellently as a suspense film, but it's also starting to look a little dated in terms of its clothes, hairstyles, and technology, which is fine, of course, but as a modern viewer, it's hard not to think about how smartphones and modern-day surveillance tech would have changed this story. Which would be kind of a shame, because it is a fascinating picture. It switches perspectives and jumps around in time so that we see what Rex knows, and then a man who is very methodically planning a kidnapping, then back to Saskia, and finally ahead to 3 years later, where Rex is still searching for her, at the expense of a relationship he has entered into since. The kidnapper is impressed by Rex's resolve and gets in touch with him, offering the chance to find out what happened to Saskia at a price. Among the many standout moments in The Vanishing is a chilling scene where the kidnapper is rehearsing part of his plan with his own oblivious teenage daughter in the car. I'd forgotten how Rex imagines the way that things might have been if Saskia had not disappeared, and how there's a dreamlike element to much of the film, sometimes lacking any clear visual cues as it transitions from reality to imagination and future to past. The director does an excellent job with composing shots and moving us through space. He regularly reinforces the sensations of claustrophobia and feeling trapped that are at the heart of the film. Stanley Kubrick once said that it was the most terrifying film he had ever seen. The original Dutch version of The Vanishing was very well received and is still highly regarded as a classic, so it was inevitable that there would be a remake for English-speaking audiences. And so there was, only 5 years later in 1993, starring Kiefer Sutherland as the boyfriend, Jeff Bridges as the kidnapper, and Sandra Bullock as the missing woman. What's unusual about the remake is that Hollywood allowed the same director, George Sluzier, to direct it. They did not allow him to write it, unfortunately, and so the very memorable ending of the original is changed significantly, a fatal blow to a film that already felt very different. The remake was very poorly received, both critically and at the box office. There is a wonderful tension in the original film between the extreme preparation of the kidnapper and the methodical search of Max, versus the seemingly random fortunes of the kidnapper meeting Saskia and Max just missing her. The kidnapper calls it destiny and says the best plans we laid at any minute can be wiped out by fate. That saddens me. And the uncertainty, the eternal uncertainty, that's the worst. This is the first time that I really paid attention to the recurring imagery of the golden egg from Saskia's dream. The original version of The Vanishing is the very definition of a taut thriller. Everything about it, from the performances to the locations to the music to the editing, is cool and efficient and devastating. I loved watching it again, and I recommend it to anyone who loves suspense, or just a film that doesn't spoon-feed the answers to the viewer. The answers are there, if you're willing to pay the price.
Roll the credits.
Sunday Night in Cinema 3 is produced, written, and recorded by Scott Marshall. That's me. With much appreciated help from Nicole Slip and the nice people at the Central Branch of the Halifax Public Library. Sunday Night in Cinema 3 is copyright 2018 by Scott Marshall, all rights reserved. Please send your feedback, questions, or concerns to Sunday Night in Cinema 3, that's the number 3, not the written out word 3, at gmail.com or through social media. Visit SundayNightInCinema3.com for our links to Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and whatever other platforms I can stand to deal with. This podcast does not have any advertisements, because I figure we all have enough advertising in our lives, but it does have some modest expenses. So if you'd like to support the podcast, you can check out my Patreon at patreon.com/ScottMarshall. That's 2 T's, 2 L's. For as low as $1 a month, you will have exclusive benefits, including outtakes and bonus material from the podcast, a heads up on what's coming up from me, and access to other exclusive digital content that I haven't even thought of yet. The Patreon also has a community forum where you can talk to each other or ask me questions, and if you subscribe for $5 a month or more, you'll receive regular packages from me in the mail of exclusive stuff including comics, art prints, stickers, game prototypes, and whatever else I can think of. Whatever you do, thank you very much for listening. I hope you enjoyed it. See you next Sunday in Cinema 3.
Good night.